Hello and welcome to this very first edition of HFS Unfiltered, the podcast that gives our executive guests a chance to speak candidly and share ideas to help define the future of business operations. So my name's Steve Dunkley. I hope you're well and staying safe as COVID-19 uncertainty continues and social distancing measures are being reintroduced in many countries around the world. So while the pandemic is trying to push people apart, distributed ledger technology is bringing us closer together. And today we're going to look at where we are in the world of enterprise blockchain, which I guess is the sexy sounding name for what's more specifically and accurately known as distributed ledger technology, or DLT, which does sound a bit like a sandwich, let's be honest. But today we're going to look at the extent to which DLT in the 2020s will be like what ERP was like in the 90s. But instead of where ERP was focused on integrating internal processes to achieve a one-office operating model, the focus now with DLT is to integrate external ecosystems, which HFS calls the hyper-connected economy. So it seems a funny coincidence that when you look at ERP in the 90s, it was dominated by R3 from SAP, and today we have a different R3 and R3 Corda. That's a key DLT platform, of course, along with Hyperledger Fabric, Quorum, and others. So in this episode of HFS Unfiltered, we'll look at the types of business problems that DLT is solving for at the moment across different industries, how DLT will evolve its relationship with ERP, and how DLT can be complemented with other emerging techs such as AI and advanced analytics in what we call the power of AND. We'll also look at what's holding distributed ledger technology back from being more mainstream, and we'll explore some of the key trends such as bulletproofs, zero knowledge based proofs, DeFi, which is the talk of the town, particularly in the financial institutions at the moment. So today we have the privilege of hearing from two executives whose companies are full steam ahead in it when it comes to DLT. So welcome to Mariana Gomez de Villa from ING Bank, based out of Holland, Rohit Amberker from Microsoft, and Saurabh Gupta, the HFS Chief Research Officer. So thanks very much, guys, for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Okay, so let's get acquainted with our panelists. Starting with Mariana, I understand you joined ING 5 years ago at a time when R3, Corda, and Hyperledger were being introduced to the world. And since then, you've been involved with 44 POCs and 8 live pilots that have involved a number of DLT platforms for various applications. So congratulations with all this great work. And I understand that out of these, the commodity trade finance program, ComGo, is in full production. So tell us a bit about ComGo and, more importantly, how that's helping your corporate clients trade more effectively at the moment.
Thank you, Steve. So indeed, ComGo was one of the first probably experiments that we ran at ING. It was more or less back in 2016 when we had an innovation bootcamp. So in the innovation bootcamp, everybody, post ideas on how can we improve certain processes. And it's a way actually that ING has to embed, you know, that innovation DNA into every single person that actually is part of this great company. So out of Innovation Bootcamp, our colleagues from Switzerland, they thought, okay, you know, this process is really paper-based and it would really help actually to modernize a little bit, to digitize this process a little bit more, and to actually be able to not only automate and have efficiency gains on ING side, but also on the whole value chain. So what they started to do, what they started talking to, for example, commodity trading companies, they started talking, for example, in that case, in that specific case of ComGo was oil and gas, you know, different companies like Shell, for example. And they actually managed to launch the first proof of concept together with Societe Generale. And what happened was we did a trade where we automated the letter of credits, right? And that automation of the letter of credit was done in Ethereum. So it was, a few years back, so Corda was not even existent then, you know. The only one that could have this privacy embedded type of, cloning the network was Ethereum. So that's the reason why it was chosen. We saw that we had a lot of efficiency gains. Actually, a transaction went from 3 hours on the issuance of that letter of credit into actually 30 minutes, I believe it was. So then for us, you know, our part, it was not only improved in that sense of just, you know, doing the documentation, for example, but it was also less prone to fraud. And you have heard probably about all the fraud that is happening in the trade finance ecosystem nowadays. You could have better, you know, real-time reporting on where actually in the process you were as a trader, where, for example, the container was, et cetera, et cetera. So we saw several advantages. looking at the client side, we also were looking for efficiency gains for them, because it was also something that we were really concerned. You know, we wanted to have a better customer experience. And therefore, we actually managed to include these clients in the pilot together with the two parties, counterparties that were trading, in that case, the oil. And later on, in 2018, we actually did another pilot with Louis Dreyfus. And then in that sense, we also, for example, included even agricultural companies, even, for example, customs. So we included a bigger part of that value chain, right? And then what happens is, when you start really including that, you start creating an ecosystem, and you start automating that full ecosystem. So then you start seeing every person that is involved there start having those efficiencies and those gains, you know, in different parts of the value chain. But at the end, it's a gain for everybody that is actually involved. And then that way, you also ensure that you have an adoption, for example, on what you're actually trying to achieve, and that you have a network effect that everybody's looking for in this distributed layer technology, right? So it's not an effort from one company. It needs to be an effort from everybody within that ecosystem. And when you see the gains from each one of the persons along that value chain is when it really counts for what innovation it's come to propose.
Sounds like a really successful project and something that's continuing as we speak. But yeah, turning to Rohit from Microsoft, it was great having you on stage in the 2019 HFS Fora Summit, where you sort of explained how you and your Xbox finance team applied DLT to solve a very specific problem that you and the game publishing industry were having. So it'd be great if you can refresh our memories about this groundbreaking application of DLT.
In the gaming ecosystem, what happened here is there are fundamentally three major problems. The first major problem that they have is because they don't have the same version of truth, right? There is a trust problem. Why am I not getting paid? Why is the calculation about the royalties that I'm getting paid is not visible to me? Why can't I see as the games are being played the transactions, right? So there is a trust problem mostly driven by the opaque nature or disjointed ecosystem. So there is your trust problem driven by these two criteria. Then you have latency. Latency is, it takes 45 days to 90 days. And if you add those people who are connected along the value chain, which is I pay to person A, person A also has a liability to pay to person B, and person B pays to C, because the way most of these supply chains works is there is no one person who's doing the job. Take a movie or a music for that matter, right? You have bunch of actors, producers, directors, associations along the way who have to do a lot of things that they all are paid from the same asset. So again, deeply connected also means that you're not connecting just within the first order of your separation, but you're connecting everybody along the way. We thought that this was a good way in terms of the use case, and we went forward, and now we have this Xbox blockchain, which is what we are using to pay our publishers, game publishers.
And it was using Azure managed services as well, is that correct?
And that was the reason why we were able to quickly move off of the POC into production, because it was all our own services, Azure services. We started with Ethereum, but eventually we figured out that Ethereum does not meet our confidentiality needs because it was a public ecosystem and we wanted provisioned ecosystem. So our need for privacy was very, 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 very high, confidentiality and privacy. So we eventually moved to Corum.
That's amazing how you just hopped across. So yeah, it was originally Ethereum. When was that? Was that early days when you switched?
Yeah, within, I would say, 6 months of our, we didn't go into production. We went into production with only two partners. And within 3 months, when it was a very quick turnaround time. Our POC was, I would say, 6 weeks. In 6 weeks, we had five goals to achieve. We achieved all the five goals. Then we said, okay, let's go slow and small and get into production. After 6 weeks, close to 3 months, at the 3 months point, we were in production.
Interesting to hear these cases, Saurabh. I mean, these live versions of blockchain are really the exception to the rule. So maybe you can give us a reality check about enterprise applications of DLT and, you know, what's holding DLT back for becoming more mainstream.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think in Mariana and Rohit, we have the good outliers, right? As we all know, we've been researching the enterprise adoption of blockchain for the last 3-4 years now, and we've collected like information for more than 3,000 different blockchain engagements at various stages, there's a lot of interest, you know, there's undoubtedly. But out of those innumerable number of blockchain engagements, less than 10% have reached production, like what Mariana and Rohit have been able to accomplish, right? Now, this has been a 3-4 year journey. Why is that still low? Blockchain is not easy, you know, it's not a slam dunk. It takes, even Mariana's case, you know, it took 2 or 3 years. And especially now after the pandemic, you know, people are looking for quick ROIs. You know, there's a dire need to transform digitally, but there are no funds, right? So I think there's that 99-1 challenge where 9 out of 10 organizations are still figuring out why should we use blockchain, where should we use it. There's another 9% or so of the organizations who are, you know, figuring out how do we build consortiums? How do we get people together? You know, how it's aligning incentives across a value chain is not that easy. You know, so it's not a technology issue, but how do you get people together, you know, to think on the same lines, to start creating shared value? It's got to be a team sport, and building a team is not easy. And then the 1%, you know, who we have here are debating, you know, interoperability, latency issues, and those kind of things. And that's important too. I think we've got to look at that funnel and see how we can create a much wider adoption, how we can cast a much wider net for blockchain applications around enterprises and give them a clear ROI, right? If they need to invest in this, there's a clear ROI at the end of the road. In my humble opinion, that's going to expand the adoption much wider.
Mm. And in terms of the partners themselves, like the system integrators, for example, and the professional services firms that are helping companies move to DLT platforms, I guess these are really essential players as well. You've studied the market out there and produced a top 10. How are you grading them? What's the sort of state of affairs with the people that can help enterprises move forward?
I think there are some service providers who are doing a really commendable job. But I would also say there's a lot of smoke and mirrors going on. What I'm advising most of these service providers is not to take this hammer and search for nails, right? And not every use case is a blockchain use case. You know, there can be a number of other technologies. It's not just because you've got a blockchain practice and you know a client, then it has to be a blockchain use case. And that's why we came up with what we call the Blockchain Bullshit Buster 2 or 3 years back, which was a set of 10 simple questions, you know, which any business user can answer. And if the answer is yes to all of them, then yes, absolutely go for blockchain. But if not, then, you know, you need to think about it. But I think, you know, companies like IBM have done a tremendous job of evangelizing blockchain. So has Accenture. Accenture, I think you've worked with Mariana as well on ING and Marco Polo, etc. There are firms like EY who are doing a really commendable job and, you know, moving beyond just being a consulting player to actually creating software or DLT software now. And then even the India Heritage SIs, right, from TCS to Infosys to Wipro, the capabilities are scaling up. So I don't think there's dearth of technical talent here. I think where we need is the mindset and leadership to bring together people. I think that's what we need to see more.
Mm. What Sourav mentioned, you know, with regards to building these type of consortia groups that are working together, you need people that is unveiling or kind of paving the way for all the others, whereas the others can, you know, little by little start progressing and start understanding and adopting these type of improvements, innovation or technology, if you may. So I think that effort is huge, and you cannot forget, you know, that you have to ask yourself the question, okay, what is in there for my clients? Why am I doing this, right? It cannot be only for your own benefits. It also has to be for your clients. And for example, in our case, we believe strongly that if we implement this technology, we're gonna be able to give them control back to them. we're going to be able to give them transparency back to them, you know, because we're in the business of trust. And if they don't trust us, you know, to take care of your assets, to actually tell you where exactly in the journey you are, then, you know, the things start getting a little bit, you know, anarchy and so on and so on. So in this case, we believe that this technology will help us bring that transparency and then control back to our clients, who are the ones that are actually deserving it, right, and trusting us to handle these transactions for them. So, and I'm sure in your case, Rohit, this is probably the same, right?
It is, because there, again, we discussed, there are two kind of early blockers for creating this, we call it network of networks, right? So there are two big blockers that we see. First and the foremost is what Saurabh mentioned, right? Which is, it is just the mindset. People think that, and technology is already an enabler. It's just that the getting the right people together to form consortium, agree on the common rules of the game, what can be done, what cannot be done, all that. People think that they are losing control. So that is a simple human mindset. That is, I think, the biggest blocker for us. Second biggest blocker, obviously, is what you mentioned, Mariana, which is kind of that common grammar, if you will, the technology talking language, because every company is used to doing things in their own way. Like Android is still Android, but you have a Samsung version of Android. Now we have a Microsoft version of Android, an Amazon version of Android, as a result of which, even though we call it Android, there are this thousands of different versions that effectively, in some ways, don't talk to each other. Right? So are we at the risk of creating a similar ecosystem that we call everything is blockchain, but they don't talk to each other, right? So that looks very plausible from where we sit today, because even within Microsoft, when we see different projects, people want to be in control. And that goes back to the first blocker I mentioned. People like to be in control of what they're doing. They don't want to give away that to a group of people or a foundation or lose that control. So those are the big two blockers.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think, look, while blockchain is relatively new, the idea of consortiums is not new, right? I don't remember in my adult life I've seen a consortium be successful, right? Why is that, right? It's just because, you know, getting people to work and live with each other is hard, right? Me and my wife, after being married for 15 years, still fight pretty much every week. what do you do? You know, that's how humans are. And I think the other thing, and we might be entering into a very philosophical debate here, is I think our economy is driven by a very individualistic, capitalistic economy, right? It's where shareholder value supersedes everything else. Right? And I think if you start to look at blockchain, you know, it's moving towards profit with a purpose, right? Whether it's trust, whether it's transparency, whether it's sustainability, you know, it's profit with a purpose. And it's sort of, you've got to have more than just the shareholders. Shareholders are important, right? But what about your employees? What about your customers? What about your vendors? Do we have a formula for evaluating profit with a purpose, or, you know, some of these larger themes? We don't. Right. And that becomes a challenge when you're trying to get C-suite, you know, asking for $50 million to invest in a DLT project. That becomes a challenge.
Right. Well, that's absolutely right. And in addition to that, if you think about it, like, you need, as you rightly said, either incentive or a forcing function for people to think about. Even without DLT, when things work, for a selfish need, like I am able to publish my own accounts, I publish my own earnings, right? And I really don't care how my ecosystem works. If that we live in that domain or that mindset, then it should still continue to work with the traditional ERP system. But if you have a belief, and there are many, many, very many signals out there where, look, this is an interconnected world, right? Where the action, like, for example, from click to ship, the customers expect from the time they click on Amazon to the time it is shipped, including with the drones now within the next 30 minutes, you cannot operate in that click to ship world unless you have these interconnected systems like blockchain.
It's interesting, you know, looking at DLT. Obviously, we're talking about it, you know, fairly in isolation. And Rohit and I, we spoke a couple of weeks ago about how you're combining emerging tech to, you know, drive even more value, the so-called power of and. So tell us a bit about what you've been up to recently with sort of the AI technologies.
You know, the thing is, again, at the end of the day, DLT is just a set of information that you can rely on, that is available in real-time basis. That is a good starting point, right? For example, today, one of the use cases that we have already deployed is in the context of royalties, when you create the statement, and the statement, let us say, is available on a daily basis, right? Do I feel comfortable releasing this statement to the partner and taking on the onus that whatever is written to the ledger is exactly the amount I pay without performing additional checks? Because we have this mindset of, you know, because of the SOX, Sarbanes-Oxley controls or our internal audit controls, we need to perform reviews, right? Then this is where we have deployed artificial intelligence, machine learning to be able to say, look, if you sense, smell garbage in, garbage out, don't write it. Right, so we have deployed machine learning in the first mile, which is even before something is written to the ledger. And then we have also deployed machine learning in the last mile, just before a statement is released. And this machine learning is helping us, we call it touchless automation, right? Which is there is no need for anybody to intervene. And that intervention has to be triggered by either a machine learning or artificial intelligence that tells something doesn't look right. So we are pushing those things out of the ecosystem, and anything that just passes within those range that we define goes into the main ecosystem. So the ledger has to have, without that, I absolutely, there is no way that we can completely achieve the touchless, trustworthy ecosystems. You have to have machine learning enabled ecosystem, because the volume at which we are operating, just that human attention is scarce, but at the same time is not scalable.
It's really interesting when you start combining those technologies, because then you can, for example, have an algorithm that is learning by itself, right? It makes decisions, or at least it prompts you a specific option so you can make a decision. And once you make that decision, you record it on a ledger, and then it's immutable, it's final, it's real time. So you start combining those different properties. It's like a puzzle, right? But you have to really be clever on when you design actually that specific value chain and that specific interaction, you know, you have to be clever on where you're going to put what kind of item and which kind of information and which kind of process and what technology are you going to use for that specific purpose, right? So it's again, going back to Surava, you know, building for purpose and then earning for that purpose.
Oh yeah, and Saurav, I was going to ask you actually, with all these technologies, what's going to happen to ERP? Is it going to be sort of made more redundant now?
I think the fundamental difference is ERP is for one single organization and blockchain has to be for multiple organizations. I think that's where the fundamental difference is. I think both will exist. In fact, if you look at what Oracle and SAP are doing, they're investing, you know, heavily into blockchain, not because they believe they'll cannibalize what they're doing, but because they believe they'll augment. I think there's a little bit of a provocativeness to the statement that blockchains will replace ERPs. I think it's a sort of a new category, because we've never had a technology that connected organizations, right? If you leave aside things like EDI, etc., we've never had a way to pipeline that would connect multiple organizations or multiple parties together where they can actually trust each other and still have some levels of automation built into it. And I completely agree with what Mariana and Rohit were saying as well. You know, what you write on blockchain is very, very important. What you write on blockchain is on you. That's where there's a lot of intersection between IoT and blockchain as well, right? Using these sensors to ensure that what's being written on a blockchain is accurate and is real time. How do you analyze all that information? That's now not just limited to one organization, but so many. You know, it's not going to be possible with spreadsheets. You need more sophisticated toys to make that happen. And that's where, you know, machine learning, smart analytics, predictive analytics are starting to creep in. It's going to be a mishmash of technologies, fortunately or unfortunately, that'll drive real value.
And I think, Steve, if you ask the same questions to Paul Brody and Marley Gray from Microsoft, actually, they will tell you, indeed, it's going to replace ERPs, right? They are working on baseline protocol. And I'm sure Rohit has asked her all about it. You know, we thought the same in the beginning with intranet, right? And now it's internet and everybody's free and everybody can do whatever they want in the internet. So we see that type of evolution, or we expect that type of evolution as well, as I understood it, in this way, in the DLT world.
The way at least we think about, we have this concept of system of record. A system of record is something that, you know, it can stand up to the test of audit. So blockchain, just if you look at the attributes that it can support, it is definitely a very good system of record. Now, the way we are using it, we call it a system of record right now. As we speak, we call this a system of record, but not a system of record that replaces an ERP. We see it as a subledger. A subledger, if royalties is one line within my 100-line P&L, you need a subledger for each one of those lines, because your ERP cannot have trillions of transactions sitting within them. So our blockchain is a system of record, but at the best, it's a subledger that feeds into the main ledger. Now, the beauty of this subledger is once you have created the subledger, then can other people, other companies in the network, my partners, their partners, can they all create a subledger? And that is an exciting possibility, which is because it stands the test of a system of record.
I think another way to sort of describe it that I've used very often on this question of rip and replace versus, you know, fill in the blank. I think the first question is, why replace something which is broadly working? Yes, now everything can be improved. You know? So plus, you know, rip and replace comes with a lot of politics, right? There'll be hundreds of different stakeholders with differing viewpoints. Nobody will be right. Nobody will be wrong. Right. And getting into a real world, you know, where it actually happens, is going to be very hard. Versus if you search for fill in the blanks, right? Where that's why provenance has been so successful, right? Because there wasn't anything else that was there pretty much that could solve for it as much as, you know, blockchain could do. So I think we need to also look at what's real versus what's, you know, could be possible, but is it really required, right? So I think it's a good balancing act. You know, it's the innovator's dilemma, because if you don't have those bold thoughts, then you'll never be able to do something. But if you just have those bold thoughts, then you actually end up with white elephants who look beautiful but end up doing nothing.
The grass is always greener. It's always best to have problems to solve for at this stage. But and also this whole thing about public and private as well. And I know that Mariana, you told me yesterday about a really exciting crypto privacy project you're working on called Bulletproofs, and you're solving the problem of data privacy on a public blockchain. So only a range of information is being divulged, which can sort of mask and protect sensitive information, which I understand is an advancement on zero knowledge based proofs. So tell us a little bit about Bulletproofs and how this can help in the real world, for example, in trade finance or in the consumer mortgage application process, for example.
Yeah, the use of this cryptographic primitive, I think, came into interest more or less in 2014, when actually you start having the boom on Ethereum and everybody started looking for different applications. Ethereum was a public network, so then you start thinking about, okay, but how can we embed privacy into Ethereum? One of the ways was by the use of Quorum, which is actually a clone of Ethereum, right? But then in our case, we start working on a payment use case, and we wanted to transfer a specific funds to another financial institution, but we did not want to let them know, you know, the balance, or we didn't want to let them know as well a lot of different parts of that specific transaction. So how can we actually protect that information, right? When you have a public network, or even if you have a private, the nodes that will compose that network will learn those type of secrets from you. So even in that case, you know, it was not the privacy and confidentiality that we needed as a bank. So we thought, okay, how can we do that? And we went into researching different cryptographic primitives, such as ring signatures, homomorphic encryption, stealth addresses. So we researched a lot, and then we found zero knowledge proofs. And we are lucky enough to have cryptographers as well working in the team. So then they started embedding, you know, these different primitives into code, and then we would test them with that code. So the first one was range proof. So how do you hide one number in a range of numbers? And that can, for example, help you to hide my age in the case I want to go to a bar and I want to drink, but I don't want you to find out that I'm 40. And I also don't want to let you know what my date of birth is, you know, because that's private. So I don't want you to know. I just wanted to know that I'm old enough to drink, but I don't want you to know how old I am. So then you could use this type of range proof, right? It would just be the same, for example, when you apply for a mortgage, when you want to prove that I'm in a location, I'm in this house, I'm in Amsterdam, but I don't want to tell you where do I live, right? So you can have anything that it remains in a number within a range, you could use it for. So for a financial institution, it was like, oh my God, this is gold, right? So let's use it. And we developed this, actually, we open source it, so it's out there. You can go to GitHub of IIMG and you can find it there, download the library and use it as you please. And then we thought, okay, this is really cool, but then we were researching about identity as well, right? So how can we enable our customers to have a better control on their own identity? And we were playing with the concept of self-sovereign identity that it's out there already for like a few years. And then we thought, okay, we need to prove then that I am a member of a set. So in a Venn diagram, you know, I'm a person, I don't know, within the European Union, but I don't want you to tell you in which country do I live. Or I want to tell you that I'm a board member and I voted for this specific rule, but I don't want to tell you who I am. So then there are no repercussions, right? So you could use it, for example, I can tell you that I'm whitelisted or blacklisted, but you don't learn anything else from me. So you could run these validations of a person or an individual within a set of, right? And then the last but not least is in the bulletproof, would we make it even faster? And as well, what we'll do is that you don't need a third party actually to run those validations for you. So you can embed those validations without actually having a trusted third party doing it for you. But I know there's a huge amount of people nowadays that is actually working on standardizing the use of zero-knowledge proofs. And as I mentioned, from 2014 until now, you know, they are really starting to become scalable. For example, EY is also using zero-knowledge proofs. There's a lot of people that actually are you know, experimenting with this technology and these cryptographic primitives for different cases. But again, you know, it requires a certain level of maturity. It requires a certain level of standardization so everybody can talk about the same and actually make sure that whatever we're building doesn't have vulnerabilities, it has the right adoption, it has the right usage, et cetera, you know? So it's really fascinating.
It's amazing. It's like blurring the boundaries between public and private now. It's like, you know, you can be operating on something which is traditionally seen as public, and as long as you've got these processes in place, you can really trade effectively, especially like they don't need to be knowing some of your competitive pricing or invoice amounts in a trade finance process, for example. You want to keep that particular bit hidden, but give them some more operational information maybe. But yeah, but I understand that obviously all these platforms, the blurring boundaries and so forth, I mean, what's going to be the winning stage? You know, which platform? You got R3 Core, you got Ethereum, you got the clones of Ethereum. What do you think, Saurabh?
I think I'll go statistics, right? So I think if you look at the stats, at least from an enterprise blockchain perspective, it seems to be a two-horse race right now. It's Ethereum versus Hyperledger Fabric, right? And then, you know, others like R3 Corda have specific use cases where they're very strong at. But if you look at general, you know, applicability, there's Ethereum and there's Hyperledger Fabric and there's a whole host of others, but these two would account for, I think if you take the 80-20 rule, I think these two would account for, you know, a large chunk of the enterprise blockchain use cases. And then which of these two largely depends on what Mariana was talking about, right? Do you want to go after a private or do you want to go after a public blockchain? And there are proponents of both. And I can talk through both sides of my mouth here on pros and cons of both approaches, right? I don't think we are at the stage where, you know, you can say that one is definitely better than the other. But, you know, especially if things like zero knowledge proofs, etc., you know, really scale up and become as good as they promise to be, then, you know, just like we, even if you look at cloud, right, we started from private clouds and now we are at least at hybrid clouds. I think it's going to be a similar-ish journey. It's not apples to apples, but you know, if I was to draw a parallel, I think it's the same journey right now. But I think these two are the ones which are sort of enterprise ready. Now then it depends on what's your use case, how risk averse or not are you, then you go with that.
You really need to think about where do you want the asset class to move? You know, what is the purpose of you tokenizing these or not? How is it gonna evolve, you know, within the value chain? So then you can really think, what technology do you need? Because as Surat mentioned, you know, each one has different pros and cons. Yeah, we have done extensive research on each one of those. I also think that it depends on the industry you're in. Because, for example, R3 Scora is obviously what's thought for specific financial institutions, you know, and now, for example, you have insurance as well, and you have other, I think it's getting a little bit more broader, the ecosystem. But the fact of that it was privacy and that it privacy first is one of the major points from R3 in that sense. So if you talk to a financial institution, they will tell you, you know, yeah, it makes sense because obviously we need those requirements, you know, we cannot use a public blockchain because otherwise the government will tell us, hey, you know, you're not going live because and every single decision that you make as well on those type of fabrics that you're going to use, how are you going to embed that privacy will have a trade-off. You know, some might be more scalable, some might be less scalable. You know, for example, in the case of Quorum, then, okay, you have the provenance, but then you might lose the reconciliation. You know, the fact that you don't need reconciliation anymore with a blockchain, you lose that because then the balances start switching, you know, from different channels that you will have open. The same used to happen with Hyperledger, for example. So then again, you know, you have to really be conscious. What do you need that? How do you imagine, how do you envision that asset to move along the way? To really come back to the right fabric that you're going to use. So yeah, I think that type of prediction, yeah, it's a dangerous one because it really depends again on the industry you're in and the type of requirements that you have.
Hey, Saurabh, do you also foresee, given the realities of people wanting to control their own destiny roadmap, do you see the winning horse here might be the one who figures out the interoperability between these various ecosystems?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Because ultimately, it'll be a network of networks, as you mentioned, Rohit. Because even if you have a network and it works, what's the point if you can't scale it up? And then you might have, you know, five other networks who are doing similar-ish thing or adjacent things. So I think interoperability is going to be a huge, huge, you know, winning theme going forward. I've seen less animosity in this industry than I've seen elsewhere, to be honest. At least on the public face, both Ethereum and Hyperledger want to talk to each other. They are part of a loose alliance, etc. So I do see less animosity than, let's say, you know, typical industries between these. And I think people realize that, you know, you've got to be able to work together. That's the whole nature of the game. That's where, you know, the third-party providers, perhaps Microsoft including, you know, also will have a big role to play on how they can make these things work together. So even if I'm making this up, Ethereum and Hyperledger fabric cannot 100% talk to each other, can there be ways around it? You know, and that's where SIs or product companies like yourselves will come into play. So I think interoperability is going to be a huge challenge. I don't think it's unsolvable. Is you know, there's so many technologists out there who are working on it. It's sort of high on the mind. I think the bigger problem for me is that, you know, that 99.1 adoption, right? What do you do to convince people that blockchain is real and it adds value? And you know, you can't kick the blockchain can down the road for far too long. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you'll have a oh crap sort of a moment in a couple of years.
That's right.
One of the things we wanted to ask you, Mariana, is obviously the hot topic for financial services, DeFi. And I understand this will be a brave new world where there are no banks or no brokers or trusted third parties. What's your take on this? Is this really the future of financial services, no banks?
The no banks, I don't believe that. At this stage, it is obviously that what they are, you know, betting for, but the same bet they took 20 years ago with the Bitcoin, right? But I do think, you know, the bank has a specific function, and that is, again, as I mentioned before, a trust function. You know, and this DeFi is fascinating. I love it. You know, it's seriously something amazing. But what they are doing is they are borrowing. Actually, everything that banks have been doing for the last years, and they're implementing it in a new system. So at the end, they are having intermediaries, right? They are having people that lend, that borrow. They are having people that are creating actually these collateralized you know, baskets, let's say, where you can actually put your money and gain your interest for. They have the exchanges. And right now they are not regulated, but wait until they start being regulated, right? They're going to have exactly the same problems as we have as over-regulated industry, you know, because they will have to attain for, again, KYC that they do have. You know, they have to ensure, for example, security. They have a lot of attacks right now. They have a lot of different ways and schemes, you know, that you can actually drain or do different stuff with against cryptocurrency people that actually own it. And right now, you know, I think, yeah, everything points out to, at a certain point, it will need to be regulated. So I wonder then what's going to happen with that. You know, they are talking about having, yeah, the same kind of like, yeah, playing field, right, as fintech was some years back. But once it arrives and the regulation is passed on to them, then they're like, oh my God, you know, I'm not sure if I really wanted this. So yeah, let's see how it evolves. But I think for us, it's opportunities. Obviously, the legislation of assets, you know, you mentioned it in the beginning with COVID, has been a little bit more the talk, actually, in this month, right? Everybody, we have been running, actually, a digitization type of effort already for quite a few years. And this only helps me to push even more, you know, this type of technology, where actually the tokenization of any asset that the bank currently has is been possible. And then you can create, again, you know, different type of business models. You can create different markets. You can have secondary markets in places where you didn't even think of before, right? You can have different type of investors, for example, attract maybe more SMEs into this kind of type of markets, where before it was more like for huge companies or for institutional investors only. So I think for us, it means a lot of different opportunities. Obviously, we need to be super cautious, again, that we always follow the regulation. And we have this regulation also for a reason. The regulation that we have is to protect ourselves, to protect, you know, our customers, to protect our people. That's the function of a bank, right? So if we don't have that, and if we don't follow this approach, then, you know, people will get hurt. So it's in our hands to actually follow these rules, and then see when the rules also hit that specific niche market, which is a DeFi, and then see what happens, you know, and then see where can we strike on those opportunities and which others we let pass, because we believe that maybe there's not enough value on it.
Sorab, you had a view on that as well, didn't you, the DeFi trend?
I think there's a, especially if you're in the US, you know, the East Coast blockchain culture and there's a West Coast blockchain culture, right? And I'm conveniently placed in Chicago, right in between. So the West Coast blockchain culture is, we'll change the world, you know, we'll rip and replace everything. Banks are the world's evil, you know, everybody, we don't need them. We can do everything, you know, that's the West Coast sort of, and I'm simplifying. And the East Coast culture is, you know, what about rules? What about regulations? What about process? How do we follow this, right? And I think the answer will be somewhere in the middle, right? Now, what exactly will come of it? Who knows? The answer will be somewhere in Chicago, right? Neither New York nor California. And I think that's what I think will happen with DeFi as well. It's sort of a pipe dream, but it's more comes back to the whole rip and replace. Why do you want to rip and replace something that's working reasonably well? You know, yes, can there be improvements? Yes. But there are so many other things that, you know, DLT and blockchain can do, which will prove it to be so much of a, you know, useful technology than DeFi is right now, right? Is why do we want to, you know, it's the same thing with cryptocurrency versus fiat currency, right? Do you really want an Xbox coin, or do you want to pay your people to buy milk and groceries? You know, while Xbox coins sound sexy, absolutely, I would love to have those, but ultimately we need to be running our lives, right? I think it's an interesting, you know, concept. It's very intellectually interesting, you know. I love to read about it, but when it comes to actually getting it done, you know, as Mariana said, it seems to be like a pipe dream.
The way we look at bank is, if you think about, if you break trust into the source of trust and the means of trust, right? The source of trust is, who do you trust? Now, for my banking purposes, would I trust public internet. Never. Because we are talking about real money, real asset value, at least for large companies, at least for many, many, many years, we will never be in a position to give away all the value to a network of players and say, okay, I'll believe in the network. So the whole part of that value will continue to be the banks for me, right? But we will force the banking to change the means of trust. If the means of trust is, give me 100 pages every month, that there will be a forcing function. And we are already seeing that, because today as we speak, if I'm expecting international payments to happen instantaneously, that's a means question, not a source question. And most of the innovation that we are forcing is in the means. And obviously when you kind of go for a scalable means, you would also expect the cost to come down. So if somebody gives me a better means and a more cost effective way of doing business, I will take it. And if it is given by my first option would be, I would force banks to do it versus a network of players who don't know anything, don't have history, and give it to them, right? So I would say we will work more with banks to change the means and bring the cost down than anybody else. I don't think the banks will go away. But the means of how do we business, we are already seeing a lot of changes already happening. And Mariana is a classical example. A lot of this projects going on, which means that they are figuring out new means to deliver trust.
We're wrapping up now, I think. Talked a bit about the applications of DLT, some of the problems that they're solving for in Microsoft and with your clients at ING. We talked a bit about sort of the ecosystem partners and SIs who are helping drive the adoption and, sort of spread the word, I guess, and get people interested and excited about the potential. We talked a bit about sort of bulletproofs and zero knowledge based proofs and, the sort of way in which the blurring of public and private can take place with this sort of security aspect. And yeah, we've talked a bit about the future of ERP as well. It's been a really great discussion. So I think any final points to make, Mariana, first of all?
To people, for example, that is starting this journey, I would say, just reach out to any person within the ecosystem. I think it's a really open ecosystem. It's an inclusive ecosystem. And that's the most important. That's actually the flag, right? That this blockchain and Bitcoin and distributed ledger has been obviously waiting for a really long time. So, and people is always, always willing to help you, always willing to teach you so you don't start from scratch. I think we also live in an era of over-information, so you can get lost quite easily. And I think that the easiest way is indeed to search for your peers and then to try to find, a way where you can be onboarded into this world of distributed ledger with a little bit of minimum effort, if that's the case.
No, I echo Mariana's points. It's one has to do it to learn from it.
I just say that, you've got to investigate blockchain today. I'm not saying you need to invest in it. You need to at least investigate blockchain if you want to avoid the, what I call the oh crap moment in 2 years down the line, because the world is moving very, very rapidly. And let's not be ostriches in the sand. Let's investigate. Let's figure it out, as Mariana and Rohit have said, and this is a very inclusive space, unlike most others, and people are. There's so much open source stuff here that I've never seen anywhere. So at least investigate, spend some time. It's fun to learn about it.
Great stuff. So yeah, well, thanks very much, guys, for taking time out. It's been a brilliant discussion, and we'll look forward to many more. Hopefully, we're doing lots of studies and events and things. Actually, we've got a blockchain event coming up, haven't we? IBM, I believe. So. Things like that, plenty of things that we can invite you to. So thanks very much for joining.
All right.
Take care.
Bye. Take care, Mariana. Bye.
Bye, guys. Thank you for